This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. And the absolute beauty of this game is you don't know what is going to happen. It is unwritten drama. The best team doesn't always win, and none of us could have predicted. All of us knew that Liverpool would hammer Manchester United, and they did. Fortunately, we have a panel of Galacticos to try and say new things about Thiago, Luis Diaz, Mane and Salah, and of Ragnik, Maguire and Pogba. Has the best Liverpool have ever played in recent times just coincided with the worst of United? Meanwhile, Fulham get the chance to lose to both of them next season after blitzing the Championship. Anecdotes, Ben Fisher is here to talk us through their chances next year and who might join them. Has any manager done their reputation less harm than Wayne Rooney in relegation? What's happening in those leagues you never look at below the Championship? All that plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning, welcome.
Hi, Max.
Hello, John Bruin.
Hello, Max.
Another great opportunity for you to say what you really think of Manchester United, John. We'll get on to that. Ben Fisher, hello.
Hi, Max.
So, Thomas says, how many Hags do Manchester United need after tonight's game? Is 10 going to be enough? QPR Stats says, does the panel think that the 4-0 scoreline tonight compared to the 5-0 result in the reverse fixture is a sign that Manchester United are finally improving? And Tom says, was it ironic that when discussing the Premier League title running during the Liverpool-Manchester United match, Martin Tyler suggested there are no easy games in the Premier League when he was observing Liverpool, in fact, enjoying as easy a game as you can get? Look, Liverpool were so much better than Manchester United in this game from the opening minute. It feels, Barry, impossible to talk about this game without repeating things that we have said before. Luis Diaz looks like he's played for Liverpool for years. Thiago passes football like no one else. Robertson is a world-class left-back. Virgil van Dijk is a Rolls-Royce of a footballer. And Manchester United, John, are shite. But there is, Barry, there is a beauty in the way Liverpool are playing now, which I guess we should try and appreciate.
Are you challenging me to come up with something new?
Well, if you can.
I mean, that it's a brilliant Liverpool performance, but it's made so easy for them.
How quickly can we? Because I think someone said, can you please spend 5 minutes on Liverpool before you do 40 minutes on how bad Manchester United are? But, you know, take the conversation where you will, Barry.
It was made so easy for them. These are two teams that, you know, hate each other. This rivalry, it goes back years. And Manchester United, they were just swatted aside, and they're so easy to play against. And calls to mind a comment below the line on the blog, you know, the Football Weekly page on The Guardian recently, when it was after the John had dismissed Manchester United and said how rubbish they were, and we were lauding Arsenal and Tottenham. And then a week later, I think Arsenal and Tottenham both lost, and Manchester United beat Norwich. And some Manchester United fan was going, Yaboo suck. Guess Manchester United aren't that bad after all. But even that game against Norwich, which they won, they were terrible. Like, they were their performance in victory against Norwich was far worse than Arsenal and Tottenham's performance in defeat. And this game last night, Thiago was brilliant, but it was made easy for him. Liverpool's front three were brilliant, but it was made so easy for them. Alisson was taking the piss. And that shouldn't happen in a game between Manchester United and Liverpool. We all knew Liverpool were going to win, and we all had a fair idea they'd probably win quite easily. But I thought, just out of, if nothing else, professional pride, and the fact that Manchester United do have some good players, they might make a bit of a game of it. But I think they were very lucky to only lose 4-0.
Ben, I'm gonna keep plugging away with Liverpool a good chat for a bit. That's not the only reason I haven't gone to you yet, John. It's just chance. Thiago, and we talked about it a bit on Monday, but there is something about the way he passes a ball. When you hear people talking about professional footballers, right, they pass the ball with incredible pace to each other, just a side foot pass. You know, it stays hit, even a pass. But like lots of people do long raking diagonal passes, but I don't think anyone hits them with the power that he hits them, which opens up the play so well for Liverpool.
Yeah, and obviously that's where Liverpool come alive with Robertson and Trent Alexander-Arnold on those flanks. And yeah, Thiago, amazing, because he feels like it was a bit of a slow burning start, perhaps, when he first joined. There was a few, I don't know if you can say question marks, but it wasn't like he sort of seamlessly slotted in and just ripping it apart straight away. But obviously now he's, as you say, just, I don't know, he can pass teams to death. And obviously with that vision and the long pass, you know, he does it better than anybody else, doesn't he? But as you say, they've got so many threats and he kind of just nudges them and sort of pokes the bear and makes them come alive, really. Must be amazing if you're a forward player to play with somebody like that. I mean, yeah, must be incredible. And I just thought Sadio, again, stating the obvious, but Mane's just been such a good signing for them. Maybe got lost again with the Salah and I suppose Firmino, when it was that front three is the peak, and he seemed to be the one that maybe got left behind a little bit. I know you could say Firmino perhaps the same, but Mane's just, I mean, that pass for the goal, just incredible. And yeah, so many things to say. We're sort of running out of superlatives, aren't we?
AP says, Mane better than Pinnock as goals? Well, I mean, it wasn't Mane's goal, it was Salah's goal, but it was Mane's pass, John. And that move, even before, like the passing was so crisp and so pure, and then the flick from Mane to Salah and the finish was so good.
Well, yeah, I mean,
I'm just waiting for you to go, yeah, but.
No, I mean, listen, no one can dismiss how good Liverpool are at the moment. They're, at the moment, the most informed team in the country, and at this point we have two of the best teams in Europe. So we can't dismiss Liverpool. And, okay, let's get to this other rabble. I think perhaps most upsetting, most not so much damning for Manchester United is that Liverpool play the type of football that Manchester United fans would really, really like their team to play. But they're incapable, particularly this lot, particularly presenting with this 5-3-2 formation at Anfield. Now, I didn't see the game live. I had an assignment elsewhere, as we'll discuss later, at Fulham. But I could have not seen any of the game, and I've seen highlights of it, and I could have told you what happened. I could have told you that Liverpool cut them to ribbons with passing, Manchester United were lax, Paul Pogba didn't show for the game, that they offered very little, and that Gary Neville, in the commentary, would start losing it and accuse them of all, you know, cheating the club, cheating the manager, being a disgrace to their profession. Because that's exactly what happened. Because that is exactly what happens to this Manchester United team. The last time I spoke to you, I think, was after the Everton game, and I, you know, said they were shite. That's not changed. They beat Norwich, who are shite. So well done. And we're at the point now, aren't we, not to get too political, a little bit like the Tory government in this country, where the club are almost having to throw PR stuff into the public domain. So we've had this drip of Ten Hag information, which has directed people away from the fact that the team is an absolute joke. But the one thing is, though, that now you're looking at Ten Hag coming in, you're thinking, how does this guy turn over this absolute joke? But the funny thing is, you know, and as the comment Barry referred to, you know, this team had, or maybe still has, a chance of finishing top four. But that doesn't mean that it's not the worst Manchester United team I've ever seen. And I've been watching Manchester United since 1982 or three. They're just a joke. They are shite.
Just to go back to Liverpool, Max, we have mentioned that we've run out of things to say about how good they are. We've run out of superlatives. We're probably going to need a lot more before the end of this season.
you're right.
We should all go off looking for new things to say and looking for, you know, getting the thesaurus out and leafing through it, because I suspect we're going to need a lot more of them before the end of the season. Now, I was chuckling to myself last night just thinking about that poor American dude having to go and ask for the fan sentiment graphs in the Man U PR department this morning, because I don't think they'll make for pretty reading. Like John, I've been watching them since the early 80s. They're, this is the worst team I remember seeing.
Are they worse? Are they worse?
And considering, considering how much money has been spent on it as well. Like that squad was assembled for £1 billion.
Are they worse than the... I'm trying to think when I started watching them, sort of 85, 86, sort of the Ron Atkinson years where they... They didn't trouble the top of the table, did they?
Well, I mean, the big Ron team used to finish fourth every season. You know, they would have flashes and it would be fun to watch. Well, that's exactly what it isn't. And even that team, even those Fergie doldrum teams between like 87 and 90, there were flashes that this could be exciting. And there was, you know, despite the Mark Robins goal at Nottingham Forest, there was the idea that the Ferguson was bringing through something, that it might happen. And do you know what? What they also had was hope. And that is exactly what this group of Manchester United players don't offer their fans.
And they also had an amazing stadium, and it's literally the same now, isn't it?
I was going to say, a friend of mine, David Easton, made this very good point, which was when you're looking at those Liverpool superlatives, the performance of them last night was like that from 1988 when they beat Nottingham Forest 5-0, which was a game that, if I remember correctly, the BBC replayed it because it was so good. And Tom Finney, who possibly the greatest English footballer of all, said that's the finest ever performance. The problem is, with making that comparison, is that Liverpool probably did play as well as that, but they were playing against a much worse team. They were playing against the absolute shite that is Manchester United.
A couple of questions that I thought were quite interesting. Charlie says, even though that game went exactly how everyone thought it would, why is it still surprising that United were so bad? And Daniel says, after the 90s, how great is it to see how shit Manchester United are? The pain they caused to so many football fans makes seeing them now so great. And I wonder, Ben, you're the generation... sort of 10 years are you younger than us? I don't know if it feels the same to you. I think there is that. And I, you know, we try and be objective, but because we had basically just decades or about two decades of them winning absolutely everything, I don't feel, A, I am always surprised when they're bad because I expect them to be good. And B, I don't really mind because they were so good for so long.
Yeah, they were definitely the team, weren't they? For myself, growing up, they were the team that everybody followed. They were the successful team. Obviously, the Fergie years. To come to that first point, though, I think the attitude is the problem that sort of sticks and really grinds people's gears or supporters' gears, I suppose, in terms of United fan base. It's just like, what are we watching here? What is this? That Fernandez sort of high, sort of crude tackled on Alexander Arnold, where I think he got booking, you know, it just sort of summed everything up really in terms of the temperament. And I think Gary Neville and others have said over the course of the season how, you know, they've lost their cool far too easily, they're petulant. I think that's the aspect, I could be wrong, but I think that's one of the aspects that really fans don't like, and that kind of really frustrates them. And I think also the team is just so... It's so soft. It's so frail. It's so vulnerable. That is completely contrasting with that Man United team that you speak of. That, you know, the one that everybody kind of hated because they were so good. They're in a really just abject place. And I mean, as for Rangnick in that kind of model and this experiment of this guy coming in short term, then moving upstairs. I mean, it's just never going to happen again, is it? It's totally killed off the thought of that happening, which at the time seemed a bit kind of, oh, what is this? You know, it felt new. I don't think anybody really thought it would be a success, but at least, you know, see if it could had some legs, and this guy came with a bit of a reputation. But yeah, it's in tatters now.
Interestingly, like United did finish above Liverpool in the league last year. I had to check this so many times to be so, like, I cannot believe that happened. And what we do... We have to talk about the Glazers, John, and what their impact has been on a club of that stature, and whether Manchester United can have success while they are still there.
One of the arguments that you always see is, I mean, I wrote a piece over the weekend talking about the Glazer ownership. One of the comments you always get from people is, hey, but they've spent a billion on transfers, so how can you criticise them? They put their money where their mouth is. One of the things that we have learned through Manchester United's foibles since 2013 is that transfers don't necessarily make you any better, because the Manchester United now is significantly worse than the Manchester United of, say, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, 7 years ago, perhaps, where there was this idea that a lot of Manchester United fans had that, and it was very popular during Jose Mourinho's reign, which was, two more windows and we'll be much better. And the idea that a magic wand would be waved, players come in, and the club would suddenly be better because they've got better players. Now, every player that Manchester United have bought, spending that billion and however much they've spent, there's a case for every one of those players coming in. They've not bought bad players, but these players have become bad players playing for Manchester United. And a lot of that comes down to the decision-making at the top, the structure of the club, the fact that the Glazers aren't going to relinquish control of the club without being paid a significant amount of money. Now, you see that Chelsea is valued at $3 million, and that's being bid for at the moment. How much billion. Was Manchester United? Sorry, billion, yeah. Well,
it's a bit Austin Powers, $3 million. I mean, that would be good value for Chelsea. Even I'd think about getting a consortium together if Chelsea was $3
million. Well, Manchester United probably is worth about $3 million right now. But $3 billion, yeah. So anyway, yeah, but what I'm saying is that when they came in 2005, they bought the club by raising the debt against the club to pay off their debt, which hadn't been done before, and it's been done since. It's been done with Burnley most recently in the Premier League. The family has used the club and the Tampa Bay Buccaneers as a bank. They take dividends out of it. It's a happy life for them. It's a free bet. They're not losing any money. When so much money is coming in and out, you get lazy. And if you don't have the right decision makers, and those decision makers don't meet the right people, and I'm not saying that Ralph Rangnick is a bad football man or anything like that. The funny thing is, you see last night at Anfield and you see him greeting Jurgen Klopp. Jurgen Klopp couldn't be happier to see him. Ahead of the game, Ralph Rangnick was talking about the players that Liverpool had that he'd found, you know, the likes of Mane, that had come through the Red Bull group that he founded. This is a guy that's achieved a lot in football. But you go to Manchester United, you've got the decision-making, you've got this incredibly badly run club where everyone is a satellite from each other, and that's when decisions start to go bad.
Tim says, since David De Gea's transfer to Real Madrid collapsed due to late paperwork and a slow fax machine, Real Madrid have won three Champions Leagues and are about to win their third La Liga title. How much must David De Gea hate fax machines?
It's interesting, actually, just that you mentioned David De Gea, because he's probably been one of Manchester United's better players this season. I appreciate it's a low bar, and yet I suspect that when Ten Hag comes in, he'll be one of the first out the door. Because I don't think he will suit the way Ten Hag wants to play at all.
Cristiano Ronaldo didn't play after the tragic loss of his newborn son. In a statement on social media, he and his partner, Georgina Rodriguez, says, "It's with our deepest sadness we have to announce that our baby boy has passed away. We're all devastated at this loss. We kindly ask for privacy at this very difficult time." They had announced the pregnancy in October. They said the birth of the child's twin sister was giving them the strength to live at this moment. We had a question from Anna saying, as losing a baby is still such a taboo subject, could you please talk about it and mention how you, an all-male pod, actually felt when you heard about them losing their son? I'm not sure of the. I think Anna is right that it is a subject that people don't talk about enough, or don't talk about at all, really. I can't speak for any of you. I think you all feel incredibly sad for somebody when that happens. It was a nice moment at Anfield in the seventh minute when everybody applauded. I do wonder, though, if our expectations are so low of football fans that the reaction of some people being respectful over a personal tragedy is treated as some kind of amazing moment. Perhaps we're right to have those low expectations. Even still, Barry, it was a moving moment, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. I was worried in the run-up to the game that, as you say, my expectations from fans are so low that it might be disrupted or whatever. But it was a nice moment. I don't have children, so I don't know what it's like to have a baby. I can only imagine it's awful to lose one. I know I have friends who have, you know, miscarried or whatever, and it's a tragedy. I've always been happy to talk about it with friends who it's happened to, but oftentimes I would be worried that these things aren't my concern and that I would only talk about it if they raise the subject first. And maybe they might feel I don't want to talk about it, so they don't raise the subject. It's a sort of catch-22 situation, but I'll be honest, I didn't realise it was as taboo as our correspondent says. But, so I'm not really in a position to comment because I don't have children.
Well, we all obviously extend our sympathies to him and his partner. I mean, we talk about expectations of football fans. Chris says, Man City at the weekend, Manchester United tonight. It happens almost every week. What can be done to address the dreadful Hillsborough chance aimed at Liverpool? No different to chance of rent boil racism, in my view, he says. And actually, John, I sort of struggle with, you know, we report when fans yell and sing horrible stuff. And I don't really know what to say, you know, and we said it on Monday's pod, I think, about, you know, the City fans interrupting that minute silence for Hillsborough. Like, short of every club has fans, a section of fans, and it may be I hate the phrase tiny minority, a big enough minority for us to all notice, that are just pretty vile people. And that is the same for all football clubs. And probably the number of those people depends on how big the fan base is. It might have slight differences with different clubs. But what else do you say about it?
Back in the 80s and 90s, there was this thing of, you know, it's provocative, isn't it? That fans of each club would say the worst thing that they could possibly say about the other team and the other team's fans to get a reaction. Now, the thing is, I think society's moved on a little bit. I think we're a little more sensitive, particularly in the media, particularly on what is considered funny on TV or radio or in newspapers that we work in. And things have moved on. So that type of behaviour becomes even more, what's the phrase, beyond the pale, really. And, you know, when you see this footage of, say, a City fan shouting the always the victim stuff, or United fans sing Hillsborough chants at Anfield because of the team's losing, those people just come across as pathetic. They're the ones, they're the losers in this. They're the ones that, I mean, what are they getting out of that? Not really anything. It just makes them look bad. And it's always done these days, or it would not always done, but in those cases, their team had lost the game. And it's just them trying to get something back. Well, if that's something that you want to take back from that scenario, it doesn't say very much about the individuals concerned. Now, you know, if you're of my generation and you went to football at that time, you were aware that what happened at Hillsborough could have happened to any group of fans at the time. And at that ground, I was at that ground. I was at Hillsborough with United a few weeks before, where a similar incident happened, yet they opened the gates and a few people were able to escape to the side, and a disaster was averted. We all knew that this type of thing could happen. And so I've always stepped back from the Hillsborough thing, knowing, hang on, this was a product of the time. But to continue, I mean, Hillsborough was in 1989, wasn't it? We're in 2022. And to be still going on about it, to be trying to be funny, well, you're just a sad case if you're doing that. And that's all that is.
Couldn't have said it better myself. That'll do for part one. Part two, before we do the EFL, we'll begin with Erling Braut Haaland's proposed move to Manchester City. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Ned says, if Haaland signs for City, will that strengthen their really small and under-resourced squad enough to be able to keep pace with the huge squad of big-spending Liverpool next season? Hayden says, if Haaland goes to City, will they ever lose again? And if so, what will we talk about when they lose now that they have a centre-forward? So the Mail reported yesterday, Haaland will be moving to City. Poor Harry Kane, says producer Joel. Yeah, missed that boat. $500,000 a week. City will trigger his $63 million release clause. Apparently, Raiola wants quite a lot of money. 40 million or something. Alfinger Haaland wants some as well, so it might be more than that release clause. You know, almost double that, plus wages. It could work out at upwards of £250 million. Do you think it's a good idea, Ben?
Oh yeah, it's a great idea from Man City. I think it's actually, I know there's sort of bells and whistles and extras and paying Raiola a little bit and, well, more than a little bit. But I still think it's a reasonably good deal in this strange world that is football. And yeah, I do think the prospect of City with Haaland, with this elusive striker that they haven't sort of had, is quite frightening. I've got a mate who's quite a big City fan, actually. And even he seems quite bored at the prospect of them getting somebody so good to fill this kind of number nine hole. Just because I think, I don't know, I suppose it's a good thing that Liverpool are so good. Maybe that would actually make it not quite so straightforward in what everybody would expect if they were to get him. Maybe it wouldn't be such a sort of cakewalk. But I do think City getting Haaland is frightening for the rest of the league. You imagine, I know we're going to talk about it, but those teams coming up from the Championship, I mean, it doesn't bear to think about. Sort of the thought of
Tim Ream is thinking, oh, yeah, we shouldn't have done that.
Exactly. Him and Adebayo are probably not too keen on that prospect.
Baz, are you looking forward to seeing it if it happens?
I kind of agree with Ben's mate. It's kind of boring. But then, of course, younger listeners probably won't remember that Erling's dad, Alfie, had a very distinguished career with City. And, you know, will he be able to follow the legacy of this extremely bog-standard midfielder who may or may not have had his career ended by Roy Keane? That's probably his most famous contribution to English football, being on the receiving end of that brutal Roy Keane lunge that was just absolutely savage. I find myself wrinkling my nose with distaste at the number, just the big numbers being mentioned in conjunction with this mooted transfer. City are already very, very good. He will be a welcome addition to their squad, but the whole thing leaves me kind of cold.
We've seen these type of deals before. You know, where you think, this team's brilliant, and now if they just add this player, they're going to be even better. One that comes to mind was back in 2006, Andrei Shevchenko joins Chelsea.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say all the way back in 2021 when Romelu Lukaku joined Chelsea.
Well, I was going to introduce that example. Yeah, where, yeah, if Chelsea just had a striker to knock them in, then they would suddenly be unstoppable. It seems quite an un-City move, really, because one of the things that their fans will say to you when you talk about how much money they've spent, and, you know, City fans, Manchester United, yes, have had a higher net spend. That's okay. You can put that one aside for now. But they've only spent, until they signed Jack Grealish for that 100 million, a lot of the players are around 60 million. You know, you pay 50 million for a fullback. It's all big money. Of course it is. But they didn't go for the superstar player. They didn't go for the superstar player in which Manchester City signing Erling Haaland is like a marriage of two franchises. Like a, you know, Marvel assembles meets, you know, DC Comics assembles. That type of thing. Haaland is an industry in himself. If you are of the, you know, transfer weirdo community, Haaland has kept you moving, kept you interested for the last 3 or 4 years. You know, the Haaland story from various people that know him. And Amino Ryle has kept that pot and that pump boiling over, and just so that eventually Manchester City have to pay all this money and all this money goes to the agent. City haven't really done that so much where they've got involved with big agency players in the fashion that, say, Manchester United have, or Chelsea have, or Arsenal. And this seems like a slightly a change in policy. And I am reminded, of course, and it was with Mino Raiola client, Pep Guardiola, Barcelona signed Zlatan Ibrahimovic. What could possibly go wrong? What did Barcelona, already the best team in football, need? They needed a big centre forward who's going to score all the goals. It ended up a complete disaster. Zlatan and Pep hated each other, and they've both gone on to great things since. But these things don't always work out, and especially when you have that sort of that extra corporate entities clashing type of thing.
Oh, well, you give us hope that it's there'll be some jeopardy in that signing. Let's go to the EFL. Fulham promoted a big pitch invasion. As producer Joel Rice, it must be nice to do that every other year. John, you were there. Did you have a nice time?
Yeah, I did have a nice time. Hey, it's Fulham. You always have a nice time at Fulham. Not in the winter, actually. That winter wind whipping off the Thames. Now, that's not so much of a factor now, of course, because they've got that big stand by the riverside, which isn't yet open, and it is hoped will be open for the new season when Fulham will again be a Premier League club. Now, yeah, the pitch invasion, I thought, was pretty raucous, and everyone seemed to be really enjoying themselves, because not everyone's as cynical as me, and I'm also not a Fulham supporter. But when I thought about it, this is their third promotion since 2017, it's their third promotion. Every summer, they've either been promoted from the Championship or demoted to the Championship since then. So they live in this sort of netherworld of being far too good for the Championship, and they have been far too good for the Championship this season and not good enough for the Premier League. And I must confess, I haven't paid the greatest amount of attention to the EFL this season. It's like rugby league. I like the idea of it. I like having it on. I don't necessarily invest my time in it. But when I looked at those Fulham players, they were all pretty familiar to me as players that have come down from the Premier League last season. Mitrovic has scored 40 goals this season. 40 goals. That's incredible. I think only Gary Whittingham has scored more in a 46-game season? Incredible achievement. And two pretty neat finishes from a player who's a very good finisher. But we know what Alexander Mitrovic is like in the Premier League, don't we? Well, he sort of embodies what Fulham are like. I'm sorry to be down on Fulham because I like the club, I like a lot of the fans, and they're entitled to enjoy themselves. But even in the post-match, Marco Silva is having to answer questions about, well, you do know that you're probably going to get relegated next season unless you change things. And he admitted it, and he said it's going to be really, really hard to. He just said, I look at it and I see that the gap is getting bigger. I know it. I know how much of a challenge it's going to be.
And that, Ben, is the interesting thing, isn't it? Is are they equipped? You know, they have a lot of the same players. Do they have any other players who you think will help them? What recruitment do they have to do? And do you have to change your style because you have the ball the whole time in the Championship and then you don't have the ball at all in the Premier League?
Yeah, I think that's the problem. And I think those teams that, like Fulham, who play the nice stuff in the Championship, you know, it's hard to get away with that in the Premier League and thrive like they would in the Championship. Say about recruitment, one of the big tasks is replacing Fabio Cavaglio, who's going to go to Liverpool at the end of his contract.
It's good. They need bolstering. So that's
exactly
good.
Especially with Haaland coming on board at City. and I think, you know, he's obviously not the first player to make that move. Obviously, Harvey Elliott's done quite well since going from Fulham to Liverpool. Be interesting how he does. He's been brilliant for Fulham this season, Cavaglio. But I think the team is just, I worry that it's a bit slow, a bit pedestrian in it through the middle. I suppose Mitrovic is not the quickest and kind of marries with that. Goalkeeper, I think, could be an issue. Centre-halves particularly. And like John says, without wanting to sort of rain on their parade, I'm struggling to get too excited. I'd be interested, actually, what the Fulham fans, when they do kind of wake up this morning and, don't know, sort of drink in the promotion, what they really think. I don't know, are they excited about the Premier League, and obviously, you know, they have the pitch invasion and the excitement of going up.
But wouldn't you rather be Fulham than Southampton, right? At least you get you get joy and then you get despondency, you get like jeopardy as opposed to 14th. I was going to say Everton, but then you never know this year, do you?
Yeah, and I think, you know, they will sign players. You know, we know that's what they will do. They'll have a go. I'm interested to see who will sort of be the glamour signing, you know, these sort of Andre Schürrle, Ryan Babel this time around. I keep thinking sort of like Arda Turan or someone might just waltz into the Premier League for a little cameo, you know, alongside Bobby Reid and Tom Kearney. I think for Fulham, that I don't. It so much does hinge on Mitrovic. You know, the teams down the bottom obviously naturally seem to struggle to score goals. And I think it was 3 league goals in the Premier League last time. Obviously 40 this time, and he's probably going to break that record. So I don't know. I think Neco Williams will probably come back, you'd imagine, from Liverpool, probably for another go in the Premier League. But there's so much work to do. And like John says, Silva already seems pretty resigned to it being, you know, quite a slog, really.
The one thing I would say in favour of Mitrovic, or in mitigation from Mitrovic, I suppose, is that the last time around, I think he had quite a long spell out injured. And then Scotty Parker was playing a formation that didn't really suit him. So that might excuse his lack of goals. So he might come good. But as Ben says, he is quite slow. And that's not great in the Premier League.
I was going to say, I think Guy Whittingham was probably a bit slow for the Premier League when he came up. He was a good player, but...
It was good.
Mitrovic reminds me of, I mean, it's an easy comparison, Timo Pukki. Timo Pukki at Championship level, brilliant, great movement, but the movement is, at Premier League level, too slow.
What's been interesting this season has been, you know, the three teams that came up, Watford and Norwich, were better than Brentford last year. But even before the season started, and I don't know if all the pundits, you know, had studied Brentford enough or were just said Brentford would do better because it was just a new team and they were interested. I wonder, Ben, when you look at Fulham and it looks like Bournemouth, do you think whoever comes up through the playoffs, and you don't know who that is, might actually have a better chance for some reason, that intangible reason?
Perhaps. I think the problem Fulham and Bournemouth, if it's going to be them, have is just because the way they play is so sort of Premier League-like, I suppose, which it sounds like a sort of compliment, but actually I think that makes life more difficult for them when they're up there. I'm trying to think, obviously, yeah, we don't know who it's going to be through the playoffs. I think the key thing is just that little sort of bit of nastiness. And you know, when we've seen Fulham before, that they're leaking goals, it's too soft, it's too nice to play against. And I don't know, that's what those teams coming up need. And I don't really see it in Fulham or Bournemouth for that matter at the moment.
I would love to see Nottingham Forest back in the Premier League. I think it's long overdue. And if they were to get promoted, I would fancy them to stay up over Fulham and Bournemouth. Right now, just speaking right now, before anyone's bought a player or done anything in the transfer market, purely because I rate Steve Cooper incredibly highly as a manager. And I think he's got something really exciting going on at the City Ground.
Let's talk about Derby, relegated from the Championship after they lost 1-0 to QPR. Their home form would have had them sixth in the table. Without the points deductions, they'd be 17th, which, Ben, is pretty incredible when you think about the squad they had when they started the season. It'll be the first time they're in the third tier of English football since 85-86. Wayne Rooney on Mel Morris afterwards said, hopefully he doesn't have a good night's sleep tonight, and that plays on his mind. Where the club's been left, it was a complete mess. I know Mel Morris is a big Derby fan. I'm sure he's sat at home tonight disappointed. Rooney comes out of the season with incredible credit, doesn't he, Ben?
Yeah, well, obviously, Barry, talking about Steve Cooper, and in Wayne Rooney, it's another sort of manager of the season candidate, really, which might seem crazy given that, you know, they're relegated, but he's done an extraordinary job in beyond challenging circumstances. As it stands, I think they've only got 5 contracted players for next season. He said they need to bring in something like 40 players to sort of replenish the first team and the under-23. So much work to do. I thought it was a really classy touch when they got back from QPR on Easter Monday. Rooney and with his squad behind him got off the team coach, all the fans waiting at the Moor Farm training base. And Rooney spoke to the fans, like seeing, I don't know, 900 or maybe even more fans there waiting to applaud the team. Rooney has handled himself really well, very calm throughout this whole process. And he's actually very calm on the touchline, which I think surprises quite a few people who haven't seen loads of him. He's very calm on the touchline, maybe not as you'd expect. And those scenes were really quite moving, really, because the bond between the fans and the team feels closer than ever. Closer than it would have been before all of this, you know, real sad sort of spiral into administration and everything that comes with it, the redundancies and, you know, job losses. And obviously the administration has just been hell for so many people at that club. And then even yesterday, so on Tuesday, Jason Knight and Aaron Cashin, two of the Derby players, went along to a children sort of holiday camp, a half-term camp, hours after relegation was confirmed. And I thought, again, that just spoke volumes as to the kind of bond that they've created, and Rooney has definitely helped create between fans and club at a time when it was so fractured because of what Morris had left behind. I suppose now it's just a case of they need to get this takeover over the line. And without wanting to sort of dramatise things, if this doesn't happen, if Chris Kirkner does not become the next Derby owner, I think we're looking at the end of the road there, which, you know, is a horrendous thought. So it really does need to happen, and Rooney has repeatedly said that. And the feeling, I should say, should stress, is that it's going in the right direction. And you think it's going to happen. Last week, the EFL, Chris Kirkner, who is the preferred bidder, and the administrators held what I'm told was sort of, you know, constructive, cordial talks. But it needs to happen. It needs to happen quickly. Kirkner said he'll take over the running of the club from the 7th of May, which is the last day of the championship season, and he hopes to have it wrapped up by June. So, you know, hopefully we're a couple of months away from some really good news. But it's a strange one, because Rooney, asked after being relegated how he feels, the first word he kept saying was just proud. So quite a strange day for Derby in a way. You know, this relegation where it should almost be all doom and gloom, but it couldn't be further from that. It's the polar opposite. And yeah, immense credit to Rooney for guiding the club through just horrendous times.
I've really enjoyed Wayne Rooney as a manager. If Wayne Rooney wasn't Wayne Rooney, as in, you know, the Manchester United's all-time goalscorer, Everton legend or prodigy, England's all-time goalscorer, when you look at him on the sideline, he looks like one of those identikit Scouse managers that you get on EFL Weekly. You know, like Accrington Stanley's like John Coleman or Steve Bleasdale that managed, was it Rochdale or whatever?
Yeah, he could be Grant McCann, you know, really quite easily. I'm not necessarily Scouse, but, you know, yes.
Yeah, a Preston's manager, Ryan Lowe. Just that, you know, Scouse football man, because Liverpool is such a hotbed of managers as well, particularly in the lower leagues. And he just, despite the fact of who he is, despite the fact of his celebrity, he does appear to act just like someone that, you know, has managed in the Liverpool pub leagues and made his way along, and his manner is much the same. And the thing is, I mean, the documentary was out recently, and we know he has a bad temper, but a lot of the time he's quite a calm, placid person, isn't he? And Wayne Rooney, of all people, is an ultimate football man, isn't he? Like he is football, and I just look at him, and you know. He actually looks, the whole look is just that of Scouse manager in the lower divisions, and long may it continue. I think it speaks a lot about Wayne Rooney.
And to his credit, massively. We should also point out that Peterborough look set to go down, which does mean the return after many, many years of the biggest game in club football. You know, forget the Old Firm or Boca River. Cambridge v Peterborough is back. For 2022-23, it's a huge game. I have to check the flights. There probably won't be space on the aeroplanes from Australia as everybody goes back for that football match. That'll do for part two. Part three, we will race through Leagues 1 and 2. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. We are still not yet completely sold out in the live tour. 13th of June in Leeds, 15th in Birmingham, 19th in Manchester, 5th of July in Dublin, 8th and 9th of July in London, 13th in Glasgow. Go to myticket.co.uk. Come along and see us. Full lineups to be announced very shortly. Ben, League One and Two, can you do them in 5 minutes?
We'll give it a go, won't we? Top three all failed to win on Tuesday, so it was a good night for Wigan in the end, who got a point, and they look like they're going to go back up. And I mean, they're quite a heartening, I know we just spoke about Derby at length, but they're quite a heartening example for Derby, and, you know, slightly different circumstances, but, you know, they were in administration, they had the redundancies in the, you know, sort of fire sale, if you like, the player sales. They had six contracted players last July. Last season, you know, they were skirting with relegation to League Two, and here they are on the brink of the Championship. So credit to Liam Richardson, the manager there. He looks like he's going to take them back up. And then it's quite tight. You're looking at MK Dons, Rotherham, who won the Papa John's the other week, but, you know, would certainly trade that in to just get over the line and return to the championship.
Can I ask a question? Can we ever like MK Dons? Is that a thing that could ever happen? Because I've sort of, you know, it's, there'll be kids now who go to MK Dons who don't know the past. Now, obviously, I imagine AFC Wimbledon fans are yelling at me, and I'm sort of throwing this out rather than saying, I believe we should be able to. Like, can there ever be a time when it's okay because of what that signified? And you know, the absolute travesty of taking a football club away from its community.
Yeah, what I would say, if you don't like them now, you're sort of never going to like them in that sense, because they're quite hard not to like in terms of the team, the manager, Liam Manning, very young, impressive head coach. The style of football they play, they've had some eye-catching loanees. I think the model is quite interesting in terms of the way they've gone about things, and Liam Sweeting, the sporting director. You know, it's really quite impressive in terms of the structure and the recruitment and the football they play. So in that sense, it's probably quite hard not to like what you see. But obviously, I get what you're saying, Max. I think there's obviously a lot of water under the bridge.
I suppose the only thing I would say about MK Dons is that what happened there and the way that it came around and the horror it caused across football, and the fact that AFC Wimbledon have come back and are where they are now, suggests that something like that might never happen again. It was nearly 20 years ago. It was such a misstep that I don't think anyone's really attempted anything similar, have they?
I don't think so. And Barry, Sunderland are seventh, flirting with dropping out of the playoffs at just the right time.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me at all. They had their odyssey to Plymouth Monday, and scoreless draw. Long way to go for a scoreless draw, but it's a good point, actually, because Plymouth's home record is very good. I have no expectations of Sunderland going up. It'll be a pleasant surprise if they do. If they do, it'll be through the playoffs. But they may not even qualify for the playoffs. So, you know, we'll see.
We'll see. I mean, we don't have to do any pods all season if we just say, hey, let's wait. We'll just see. What's your hunch, Ben? Because some big team, like Sheffield Wednesday, you know, in that mix as well. Alongside Plymouth, who had a good season. You know, Wickham, who could bounce straight back.
Yeah, and Oxford had a big win just to sort of keep them just about in the mix as well. Sheffield Wednesday, I think, would be interesting. Wickham play Sheffield Wednesday this weekend. You feel like if there's a winner, then that would be quite a big, significant step. Wickham obviously hoping to go back up themselves, immediate return. Adebayo Akinfenwa was last season, so he's only got two games as it stands, and obviously if he goes into the playoffs, he'll have a couple more, so could be a big, big end of the season for the Beast.
He scored on Monday against Wimbledon, his former club, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right? Yes.
Yeah, Wimbledon struggling as well, aren't they? Sort of, you look at it, crew are down. Doncaster and AFC Wimbledon look like they're going down, and then, I mean, they could Fleetwood, Gillingham and Morecambe for the other place. Is that sort of how you read it, Ben?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think in terms of the teams that are going down from League One, there's no massive kind of shocks there. I suppose AFC Wimbledon got Mark Bowen in as a kind of last ditch attempt to try and stay up. But yeah, it looks like it's going to, you know, might not be enough.
There was a moment in the Fleetwood Gillingham game, it was a goalless draw, and two players went in and both went in two-footed and both then did that spinning away on the ground thing and looking in agony, whether they were or not, we don't know. And then both players from both teams ran up to the ref going, have you just seen what he's done? And the ref sent them both off. And I thought it was a brilliant piece of refereeing. I don't know if anyone else saw it and agrees or disagrees.
I did see it. He sent both of them off. I think one of them had... He got his marching orders, but he was carried out on a stretcher. So I hope he's okay. Because it was a... Yeah, it was brutal.
If someone brings in Mark Bowen, do they not have to bring in Eddie Nedveski and perhaps Mark Hughes as well? Like that, is that band's been broken up now, hasn't it? Well,
yeah, because Hughes is at Bradford.
Yeah, surely you could have got Mark Bowen in at Bradford.
and you didn't. Hughes didn't take them with him at Bradford. That's very upsetting. How are they doing in League Two? Not well, Ben.
Yeah, well. the season's fizzled out for Bradford. Obviously, a massive team, they get huge attendances in that league. But I think, yeah, there's clubs that are vying to go up there, not one of them. Bristol Rovers under Joey Barton could still sneak an automatic promotion place. And Sutton United could get back-to-back promotions, which would be, you know, amazing for a team, really. You know, for a team to come up from National League and go straight through to League One on such a modest resource would be incredible. Down the other end, Oldham looks set to follow Scunthorpe in being relegated. They'd be the first Premier League club of that sort of 90s era to get relegated from the Football League.
You're getting the electric coach, Ben, with Forest Green to Bristol Rovers on Saturday. Are you excited to see where they park it?
I am. I've had many thoughts go through my head, among them turning up in a guzzling diesel. I don't think it's going to go down too well. But I'm looking forward to it. It should be good. I hope it's fully charged. And I think it's got a 200-mile radius, so that's ample for that trip. But yeah, very much looking forward to it. And it could be a promotion party on the way home, so let's keep the fingers crossed.
Forest Green have been struggling to get over the line, Ben, haven't they? So they got thumped by...
Barrow,
yeah. Phil Brown's Barrow, no less.
Phil Brown, indeed, yeah. And then Monday was a massive result for Forest Green, because as you say, Barry, they were making a meal of it. But I think Monday has put them... I think technically they need a point this weekend, but they really, their goal difference means they're almost there.
If they haven't done a T-shirt with Phil Brown pushing a wheelbarrow, then perhaps we should for merch. VAR is going to be introduced into the Scottish Premiership from December. It was a funny time to bring it in. But they.
I'm sure that will cure a lot of arguments up there. What could possibly go wrong?
It will be used with the principle of minimum interference, maximum benefit. Good luck,
right.
Everybody.
Yeah.
There.
Yeah.
I think that is an absolutely disastrous decision they've reached there, and I think they will rue the day that they introduce VAR to the Scottish Premiership.
Do you know what? I, for one, welcome it. Scottish football really needed an added extra element of chaos, isn't it? So let's have it. Let's have some more of that, please.
Shane says, last night I had a dream that I walked into an off-licence of which Barry was the proprietor. He recommended a new drink which came in the form of a coffee-like powder, which both made you drunk and sober at the same time.
Bloody hell.
Has Barry ever worked in an off-licence?
I haven't, no. In terms of retail, I've worked as a waiter in a restaurant. I've worked in a betting shop. And I've done a couple of stints in pubs. That's about it.
If somebody in the restaurant said, this steak is too well done for me, were you quite obedient? Or did you just
I was actually a
say,
very
I don't
good
care.
Waiter.
Were you?
I was a far better waiter than I was a betting shop cashier, a journalist, a podcaster, or a barman. I think being a waiter might have been my calling.
Anyway, well, perhaps you could at the live shows.
I was incredibly courteous and polite. Yeah, I would have surprised you, Max. I reserved all my belly aching for behind the scenes in the kitchen.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know.
When I was a student, you used to have this thing where occasionally have these student nights where famous people would work the bar at the student union. So I remember Nigel off EastEnders doing it, and Ross Kemp as well at one. I didn't attend that. Yeah, Ross Kemp working behind the bar, you know, being Grant Mitchell, you know, for some sort of chat. And then Nigel's actually performed in a blues band after that, who were absolutely terrible. But I'm just thinking, could this be a sideline for Barry? You know,
so we say after the live shows, because he loves meeting the people. We know that. Absolutely. If you do come to a live show, make sure you collar Barry and talk about football tactics for at least 45 minutes. if we could get him working behind the bar. Listen, we've run out of time today. Football Weekly was produced by Joel Grove. Our executive producer is Danielle Stevens. Thank you, John.
Cheers, Max.
Thanks, Ben.
Thanks, Max.
Thanks, Barry.
You're welcome.
We'll play out with one of Liam McClare's loops. It was recommended by a listener who enjoyed the discussion between Philippe Auclair, Barry, Nicky and myself about whether a shithouse was just a shithouse or a shithouser or et cetera, et cetera. You can have a listen. We'll be back tomorrow.
This is The Guardian.